Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Schloem. In this episode, we conclude our special two-part look at the Drake equation. It was written by radio astronomer Frank Drake in 1961 as a way to organize the first scientific conference held at the Green Bank Radio Observatory in West Virginia on the search for extraterrestrial civilizations. Since then, the equation has been a guidepost for those interested in the fundamental question, are we alone in the universe? If you missed part one of our program, no worries. You can check that out later on our website, mynspr.org. To simply recap what the equation equals, it is N, the number of civilizations in our galaxy capable of interstellar communication or at least detection. In our last episode, we looked at the first four terms of the equation, the rate of star formation in our galaxy, the fraction of those stars that have planets, the number of those planets that are potentially life-bearing, and the fraction of those planets on which life has actually arisen. Our guide once again and my special co-host will be Bill Diamond, President and CEO for the SETI Institute, a nonprofit scientific organization dedicated to the search for extraterrestrial intelligence specifically and life beyond Earth in general. In this episode, Bill and I will be joined by two of his scientific colleagues at the SETI Institute, Lawrence Doyle and Sophia Shake, to look at the final three terms in the equation. Later on in the show, Sophia looks at... Later on in the show, Sophia joins us to look at the fraction of planets with civilizations using technology, and in our final segment, Bill and I will examine one of the most intriguing and ominous of all the terms, the lifetime of those civilizations, which of course has implications for our own. But first, Bill Diamond and I are joined by SETI astronomer Lawrence Doyle as we look at the fifth term in the famous equation, F sub I. Bill Diamond and Lawrence Doyle, welcome to Blue Dot.
Oh, thanks very much. Good to be here.
Hi, Dave.
Well, Bill, why don't you tell our audience what we're talking about this time? What is F sub I?
Well, it's great to be here and great to have Lawrence with us. And we're going to talk about F sub I, which is part of the Drake equation. And we learned in our last conversation about F sub P and N sub E. And we learned that planets are pretty much ubiquitous in our galaxy and by association in other galaxies as well. That pretty much every star has one or more planets around it. And we also learned that a very high percentage, potentially as high as 50% or even 90%, as Doug Caldwell told us, could potentially be planets in the habitable zone of their host star and rocky Earth-like planets in size. So that brings on the idea that a large percentage of planets could potentially be habitable and have life emerge on them. And if that happened, some fraction of those, we believe, would have enough time and evolutionary processes take place for intelligent species and complex organisms to emerge. And so that's what we're here to talk about today with Lawrence.
Well, Lawrence, when you talk about something like, okay, we've talked about F sub L, the fraction of planets that have life on them, you know, perhaps very primitive, primordial organisms, that kind of thing, but maybe higher forms of life. But when you get to F sub I, it's very, very conjectural. We only know of, you know, a few species on Earth that are intelligent, and there's debate about that. But as an astronomer and somebody working on this problem, how do you go at F sub I? What are some of the ways you can kind of try to suss out what might be going on?
Well, one of the approaches we use is called information theory, and it measures the complexity of communication. And of course, all animals, and for that matter, plants communicate. So once you admit that, you say, okay, well, then we just want to know how complex that communication system is. Well, to do that, you can actually use information theory, which is the mathematics developed at Bell Labs to basically figure out how many telephone lines to string. But it also quantifies and introduced the term bits. It quantifies in bits the amount of information that's being transmitted. And that we use as a proxy for communication intelligence. So some animals communicate just a single burst, like squirrel monkeys have a term for snake, and that means crawl out in the end of the branch. And they have a term, screech, for eagle. And you do not want to go out on the branch if an eagle is coming. So it's important to understand the difference between the sound for snake and the sound for eagle. But that's a one-to-one correlation. You can hear a sound and then see what the action is. But in human, we're talking about squirrel monkeys right now, and there isn't any squirrel monkeys here. So we use symbolic communication, and that can be way more complex. So basically, we're interested in what is the complexity, measuring directly mathematically the complexity of communication systems, and use that as a proxy for intelligence for F sub I.
And Lawrence, when we talk about intelligence and intelligent species, I guess it's fair to say that there isn't a kind of universally agreed definition for what constitutes intelligence and what constitutes an intelligent species. But at the same time, we have a sense that in the mammalian population in particular, as well as others, there's actually lots of what we believe to be or consider to be intelligent species. Is that correct?
Well, yes. You know, we've spent the last couple centuries outgrowing this notion that the human physiology sprang out of nowhere and is not connected in any way with the other animals and plants. And we kind of got over that, especially when we realized the genetic code of plants is more complex than the genetic code of humans, because, of course, they make their own food and eat it, whereas we just eat. And so we're in the midst of realizing that human communication systems are also not, appearing out of nowhere and being completely separated from the other communication systems on Earth. We're realizing that there are a lot of mathematical measures that demonstrate the complexity of communication systems of many species on Earth. You know, the trend we started 400 years ago of placing the Earth in the universe instead of in the middle continues with deprovincializing our view of intelligence. Today, it's taking place by placing human communication systems in a kind of a continuum. And we're beginning to find out mathematically if we are the most complex communication system on Earth.
And you've also been involved in some fascinating work recently with humpback whales, with a certain humpback whale named Twain, and we did a whole program on it. But I'd like you to maybe briefly delve into how that's an example of intelligence on Earth.
Yes, the communication system of marine mammals, and in particular whales, is global. And we decided to pick whales because they put most of their communicative exchanges in audio, which we can record. People say, well, could you work with chimpanzees? Well, yes, but they have facials and gestural communication systems too. Whereas the marine mammals generally put most of their communicative exchange in the audio, where we can quantify it. So we decided to work with humpback whales because they use tools. They make nets out of bubbles, and we have tried to catch fish with with bubbles, and you have to try it to realize how difficult that is. And yet there's a technical skill that humpback whales have developed, and they have a complex network of social exchanges, and they use their social calls in Alaska, and then they sing when they go to Hawaii to mate. So they're not feeding in Hawaii. They're mating and singing. And then when they go to Alaska, the same pod has complex social calls, and they're feeding. They have to coordinate who's going to make a bubble ring and who's going to come up underneath the bubble ring with their mouths open and so on. So they're complex socially, and they're complex communicatively, and they're technically complex too in the way they develop bubbles into tools. So that's one of the reasons we picked humpback whales in particular, because they vocalize in our range of communication. And at surprisingly, for something that weighs, 1,000 times as much as we weigh, they communicate at a temporal pace that's about the same as ours. And so we had this hypothesis that we would try what's called a contact call. And it goes kind of like that. And we tried it out, and Twain responded, turned around, came and circled the boat. And we had an exchange that was only limited by our permit. The permit said that we couldn't play back more than 20 minutes. So, but we had this 20-minute exchange with a humpback whale in humpback.
Yeah, very cool.
I might just add, we have an example. This is the next paper of a humpback trying to imitate humans. So we're reaching out both directions.
Wow. Well, when you think about F sub I in the universe, I've often thought of whales as something to think about in terms of there may be water worlds out there with intelligent beings that live in the oceans of an exoplanet. But that would be very hard to detect, wouldn't it, Bill?
Well, it's an interesting question. I think on the one hand, if we were trying to think about the conventional techniques we use, it would be difficult. There's no chance that we would detect any kind of radio transmission or something that could extend well beyond that planet's immediate environments. On the other hand, we know about life, even simple, basic life forms, that they impart a signature on their environment through patterns. Even microorganisms can impart patterns in geology and surface morphology that, you know, belies their presence. And you can observe patterns from, for example, orbital scale distances. So we do have a question, since we know that life imparts signatures we can potentially detect from a distance, including, for example, potentially the composition of planetary atmospheres. And since we know that technological civilizations can also make their presence known over great distances through techniques like radio astronomy and optical astronomy, et cetera, there's an interesting question about whether intelligence imparts any kind of signature in its environment that we can detect. We don't really know the answer to that, but people like Lawrence are working on that kind of question. But it's an interesting line of inquiry to say, you know, is there something about intelligence that would leave a mark or signature or pattern of some kind of evidence on its environment that we could detect even from, say, significant distances? A very intriguing question.
Lawrence, you want to add to that?
Well, yes. Like, take, for example, a pod of a large conglomeration of, say, bottlenose dolphins. They can be up to like a square kilometer of churning water, and you see this pixel that's moving around in the water. And I'm surprised nobody's kind of pointed this out, but you could detect intelligent motion, non-random motions of a pixel in water as this pod of dolphins, or for that matter, humpback whales. I mean, I've seen, you know, hundreds of humpback whales can get together and go and fish after, you know, herring in particular, but also krill and sardines and so on. So, you know, we're just beginning to look at biosignatures that are intelligent, and we're basically, F sub I fills in the gap between biosignatures and technosignatures, and it's a brand new science. So stay tuned on all that.
Well, Lawrence Doyle, astronomer from the SETI Institute, thanks for joining Bill Diamond and I to talk about this part of the Drake equation, F sub I, the fraction of worlds where intelligence has arisen.
My pleasure.
Thanks to our guest, SETI astronomer Lawrence Doyle. We're going to take a short break, but stay with us. When we come back, we'll continue our exploration of the Drake equation, which was created in 1961 by radio astronomer Frank Drake as a way to get at one of the greatest of all questions, are we alone in the universe? I'm Dave Shlom, and you are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back. If you're just joining us, we're exploring the state of the Drake equation in 2024 with our special co-host, Bill Diamond, president and CEO of the SETI Institute. The Drake equation was written by Frank Drake, the radio astronomer many consider to be the father of modern SETI, the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, as a way to organize the parameters for the number of civilizations that may exist in the Milky Way galaxy. Bill and I are now joined by postdoctoral fellow and radio astronomer from the SETI Institute, Sophia Shake, as we examine the penultimate term in the Drake equation, F sub C. Sophia, welcome to Blue Dot.
Thank you so much. I'm happy to be here.
Well, Bill, we're to the penultimate term of the Drake equation, F sub C. So give us a quick description of what F sub C is.
Sure, Dave. Well, and again, big hello to you, Sophia. Thanks so much for joining us. So F sub C is where the Drake equation transitions from the domain of astrobiology, which is looking for life of any kind in the universe beyond Earth, to the domain of SETI, where we're using technologies to look for evidence of other technologies, so-called technosignatures, beyond our solar system as a proxy for life and intelligence. So it's really, you know, kind of the business end of the Drake equation, and that which is really at the heart of the things we do at the SETI Institute, since we're all interested in finding life beyond Earth, but we're especially interested in the idea of finding technological life that we might communicate with, or at least be able to exchange information with if they were close enough.
Yes, it's the search for extraterrestrial intelligence. So that we're into that interesting part of this world of SETI. And I'm just wondering, for you, Sophia, can you talk a little bit about, you know, how you've seen radio astronomy in terms of using it for the search for extraterrestrial intelligences and civilizations, some of the evolution that you've seen? And, you know, and Bill, you can comment on that too, but I'd like to know, like, how far have we come since the early days of SETI?
So the short answer to that question is a long, long way. The evolution in radio technology from the beginning of the SETI field in the 60s with the first searches by, say, Frank Drake at Green Bank Observatory to the worldwide collaborations that are going on now is just sort of stunning. To give you one particular example, when those first SETI searches were going on, so when Frank Drake was doing his Project OSMA search at the Green Bank Observatory, he was basically going through one radio channel at a time and listening to see if there were any signals of technological origin in each of these channels. And those channels are about a hertz wide. So for scale, very, very narrow, hundreds of times narrower than astrophysical phenomena that we know about in our galaxy. And now, with sort of our modern instrumentation that we have on the Allen Telescope Array and other similar radio instruments that are being used for SETI, we can cover billions of hertz-sized channels at a time, record them all simultaneously, and then search them all at once, which really speeds up the search. The parameter space is huge, but the progress we're making is also so much faster than those early days. So it's a very exciting time to be in the field of SETI.
And I think that's what's key here, Dave, is what Sophia mentioned about the speed, because we're still limited to, you know, how much of the sky we can observe at any given time. And what you'd really love to do is observe all the sky all the time, so you wouldn't miss anything that just might happen to pass us by. So, you know, we're still, I would say, far away from that kind of globally comprehensive, all sky, all the time analysis. But we are making progress. And as Sophia mentioned, worldwide collaborations between radio telescopes and instruments and organizations around the world. So much, much more orders of magnitude, both in data acquisition and parameter space examined, is being done now than ever before. But still, you know, we're just like dipping a measuring cup in the ocean and trying to understand the ocean in terms of the vast scale of the parameter space and this question of, for example, well, why haven't you found anything yet? You know, we're still, you know, far away from what anybody would call, you know, a comprehensive, exhaustive search.
Yeah, I remember Jill Tarter, you know, using the analogy of going to the ocean, going to the beach, dipping a cup into the sea and looking at it and seeing no fish in there and saying, well, I guess there's no fish in the ocean.
Exactly, exactly.
Well, I'm wondering for our listeners out there that might be thinking about this, there's so many natural phenomena that produce, you know, radio signals that you detect using radio telescopes. And I remember when pulsars were first discovered, for example, rapidly spinning neutron stars, putting out these pulses of radiation, they were referred to kind of jokingly as LGM, for little green men. But I'm wondering, what are some of the things you would be looking for that would indicate this is not a natural phenomenon?
So that's one of the biggest challenges in astrobiology generally, right? Is trying to determine, like, okay, you found a signal. Is that signal from life? Or is it from some non-life abiotic phenomenon that just happens naturally on planets? And we kind of face the same thing in SETI, but we get a little bit of a head start because of this signal narrowness thing that I sort of brought up in the previous discussion. So the idea here is that on Earth, to make our communications as efficient as possible, probably for any listeners, the way that they're receiving this broadcast is going to be through some combination of fibers and radio waves. And the radio waves are going to be really, really narrow. So you can imagine it like a laser that's only one very, very clear, pure color, but in the radio wavelengths. And that's because it's just energy efficient to do it that way. It kind of works really well with the technology we've built on Earth. And so we can imagine that those really narrow signals might also be used for interstellar communication. They're efficient, they travel at the speed of light. And here's the kicker, even the narrowest astrophysical phenomena are generally hundreds of times wider than the signals that we use here on Earth. So the most obvious filter that we use is just looking for things that are really, really narrow in their kind of frequency span, because we know that, you know, as far as modern astronomy and physics tell us today, there's nothing natural that can produce signals like that. Turns out the bigger challenge is there are a bunch of human signals that are very, very narrow. All of these things, sort of Wi-Fi, GPS, even your like car key clicker. So determining that something is technology is actually easy. Determining whether it's human technology or extraterrestrial technology is surprisingly difficult.
What are some of the difficulties there? How is that difficult to determine if something's coming from Earth rather than, you know, a point in space?
Yeah, it has to do with how radio dishes work. And the basic idea, you know, you would hope is that you would point your radio telescope, like point your dish toward a star, and you want to see if the star is making any technological signals. So you gather data from that star and you look and you see whether you find any narrow signals in it. And this is a big part of my research. And I can do a scan for, say, 5 minutes and get hundreds of thousands of hits in that single file.
Wow.
And the reaction is not, wow, I found 100,000 alien signals. It's, I found a giant haystack of radio frequency interference, or RFI, and I have to sort through that haystack and see if there's anything left that seems to be truly coming from space. And that part's just really challenging. One of the filters that we use is to see if we can determine whether the signal came in kind of through the source that we were pointing at, or whether it's coming from somewhere in the local area, like a cell tower or a Wi-Fi router. So there are different tests that you can do to see if your signal is what we would call sky localized. But even then, you can find a sky localized signal and it could be a satellite or a plane. So then you start having to cross-reference with databases of signal transmissions, and it can get pretty complicated to determine whether a signal is truly coming from a distant interstellar source.
But this is why, David, that one of the first and most immediate protocols following what we might observe, for example, with the Allen Telescope Array as something interesting, would be to have another observatory in another location point to that same set of coordinates in the sky and see if they say the same thing. Because if they do, you know, that suggests something distant, potentially beyond our solar system. And if they don't, that suggests that, as Sophia said, it, you know, might have been a passing aircraft or satellite. But of course, you know, trying to get rid of as much of this background noise as possible is why radio telescopes happen to be built in, you know, remote areas away from human technology as much as possible, which also, you know, makes them often located in rather beautiful, pristine parts of the world, which is kind of nice. But it's all about trying to get rid of that noise problem.
Yeah, I know when you go visit the Allen Telescope Array, you know, there's little signs right when you enter saying, you know, turn off your cell phones and, you know, make sure you're not leaking any RFI yourself as a visitor.
Now it's about turn off everything because the cars have so much electronic, you know, radio frequency emissions. It's like, turn off the car, turn off your Bluetooth, turn off the phone, turn off your whatever that's called, the AutoStar system for safety, et cetera. But we have to try to mitigate as much of that background noise as possible.
I'm curious about something. I was thinking about this the other day. We have so much more technology now than we did when at the beginning of SETI, say, in, you know, in the early 1960s, you know, into the 1970. But I'm also curious if someone was, say, 50 light years away and they were doing SETI and they were pointed at Earth, would they notice, like, if they could look at our signal now in real time versus back in 1965, let's say, would the Earth be radio noisier now or quieter?
Yeah, it's a good question. And there's actually been a couple of recent papers kind of addressing the change in the Earth's radio signature over time. So one of the dominant terms right now is cell towers. So that's like 4G and 5G. And there are just so many of them that even though they tend to broadcast kind of sideways, like down toward the Earth's surface, you still get a lot of leakage if seen from really far away. So we're not quite at the point yet where with our modern radio arrays, we would be able to see a signal of that strength, even from, say, 5 light years away. So 50 would be a bit of a stretch. But you could totally imagine that maybe a civilization that had built much larger radio arrays or much more sensitive ones might be able to detect something like our cell phone LTE leakage signature right now, which is kind of cool. So it's on the threshold of detectability. It's something you could definitely imagine if you had instruments a couple decades more advanced than maybe what we have right now.
It's a changing landscape, or maybe radioscape, for sure, as Sophia has alluded to. I think the other thing, though, is while our radio and television broadcasts are becoming less, you know, less powerful, less even in existence, you know, we're replacing this with, you know, internet streaming services. At the same time, we have airport radar, which is probably these days the most powerful kind of transmission that we're sending from Earth. We used to, of course, be transmitting with the world's most powerful transmitter at the Arecibo Observatory, where we were using a 1 megawatt transmitter to look to bounce transmissions off of asteroids as part of planetary defense programs for NASA to track them and identify them, their orbit and their characteristics and so forth. And, you know, somebody with an Arecibo-like dish and Arecibo-like transmitter on the other side of our galaxy would be able to observe that type of transmission. But since Arecibo collapsed, of course, that's no longer happening. Nevertheless, I think airport radar is probably the most powerful kind of signal that's being emitted from Earth, and certainly compared to, say, 25 years ago, and certainly 50 years ago, et cetera, there's many more airports and more powerful transmitters and more of them. So it's true that in terms of radio broadcast of the conventional sense, we're getting quieter as a planet. But as Sophia says, with things like constellations of cell phone towers, et cetera, we're probably not getting quieter in the radio spectrum, you know, broadly.
Sophia, for you, I imagine, you know, sometimes late at night when you're laying there with your quietest thoughts, you think about what would it be like for me if I do detect a signal? And I'm just wondering if and when, you know, a signal is detected and you get it confirmed, what happens then?
It's a great question. And I don't know that you'd get a uniform answer, even if you ask maybe 5 people in the field. And it'll really depend on exactly what the signal is. So In radio SETI, we kind of make this distinction between a beacon or a signal tone, where it's like basically a we are here sort of message, because nothing natural could make that signal, but it doesn't carry any information. So if we see that, you know, we would certainly be turning a bunch of radio telescopes around the world to look at it, be studying this phenomenon, trying to understand more about it. But we couldn't tell that much about whoever built it just from the fact that it existed. It wouldn't carry any additional, like, Encyclopedia Galactica or anything like that. Versus a signal that did carry information, suddenly I think the search becomes a lot more interdisciplinary, right? We need linguists, we need computer scientists, we need cryptographers who would all start trying to figure out, like, what information does this signal contain? And then if we could figure out what information it contained, then what is it? How do we respond to it collectively, right? There are a lot of different branching paths there.
And of course, you know, depending on how far away it is, you know, let's say it's, you know, 100 light years away, it's not like you can just, you know, send an acknowledgement signal, because you can't have a two-way conversation where it takes 100 years, you know, for a message to go one direction.
Well, you can, but it will take 100 years. So
right. After I'm dead, I'll find out.
The answer you get won't be very timely.
Like, this question of what do we do next, what happens, falls under this umbrella of post-detection. And post-detection is something that we've been thinking about since the start of SETI in the 60s. So we've had social scientists and science communicators and people from outside of kind of an astronomy discipline working with us in the SETI field since its inception. So I don't want to not do justice to the work that's already been done. This is something that we think about a lot and we take very seriously. And certainly there are a lot of open questions, and we still need to understand public reaction and understanding of kind of what the public conception of life in space is. So there's a lot of work to do, but it's important to do it before there's any potential discovery and lay those foundations early. And there are a lot of amazing people kind of working on that with us within the community, which is really exciting.
Well, on that fascinating note, I want to thank you, Sophia Shake, postdoctoral fellow and radio astronomer at the SETI Institute, for joining Bill Diamond and I to talk about F sub C, the fraction of worlds with civilizations.
Yes, thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed chatting with you all.
Thanks to our guest, SETI Institute radio astronomer and postdoctoral fellow Sophia Shake. We're going to take a short break, but stay with us. When we return, my special co-host Bill Diamond and I will continue our look at the Drake equation in 2024 as we examine the final term in the equation, the lifetime of a civilization. You won't want to miss that. I'm Dave Shlom, and you are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back, and thanks for listening. We conclude our look at the Drake equation in 2024 as Bill Diamond, president and CEO of the SETI Institute, and I turn our attention to the final term in the equation. Bill, tell us, the letter L, what is this final deeply intriguing term in the Drake equation?
Well, Dave, I like the introduction because it sounded so ominous, like the end of the Drake equation. So, yeah, L, it was meant to represent the longevity or the duration of a technological civilization's remaining detectable. And so again, the starting point is a civilization which has already attained technology, which then can extend its presence beyond its, you know, immediate environments, out beyond its own solar system, for example. And that includes things like radio transmissions or laser transmissions or things of that nature. And Frank surmised that ultimately, you know, a technological civilization emitting technologies that we or others might be able to observe from a distance might not be able to do that forever, or might not be inclined to do that forever or for a long period of time, that there's going to be a limited window of opportunity, if you will, amount of time in years, which is what L is represented by. It's a variable that is represented in number of years. How many years does a technological civilization remain detectable before various different scenarios might play out. And these could include, you know, the accidental extinction of the civilization by virtue of things like an asteroid, which, as we all know, was the demise of the dinosaurs, or, you know, a massive volcano that would, again, alter the atmosphere in a ultimately existential manner, or some other natural catastrophe. And then there's also extinction caused by the fact of technology arising on this world and the byproducts of that technology, things that might happen as a result of messing with the atom, such as a nuclear holocaust, or things that might arise as a result of messing with biology, such as a, you know, a global pandemic, or perhaps most seriously, you know, a modification unintentionally of the climate and environment of the species in a way that ultimately results in the demise of that species. And then the other scenario, the third scenario, and perhaps the more hopeful one, is that a civilization survives its technological adolescence, if you will, figures out how to overcome the unintended consequences of their technology and survive for millennia or even longer. And so anyway, all of these types of scenarios Frank felt were important to represent if you were going to try to estimate the number of technological civilizations out there. And he lumped them all under this variable L. How long does a technological civilization remain detectable?
So, you know, in our case, and, you know, all of those scenarios you just kind of ran through, pandemic, climate change, nuclear holocaust, you know, those are definitely things that have been kind of hanging over our heads like the sword of Damocles here for a while. And I think when you look at the term L, and I know Carl Sagan spoke and, you know, wrote on this quite eloquently, that, you know, that was his big concern, that part of the Drake equation always kind of gave him pause and was one of the reasons he was quite an activist about things like global warming and nuclear weapons and, you know, that kind of thing. So what would be the lifetime of our civilization if we're looking at, you know, how long have we been detectable? What, a couple hundred years?
Not even. I mean, it depends on what might be detected and what the observation technology would be. But in the context of SETI, where, for example, we use radio telescopes and now optical instruments to look for laser pulses, lasers being used for communications or propulsion or other things. But we've been emitting radio signals for about 100 years. And so we can think about it in along the lines of the Earth's technosignature in the form of radio, later on television broadcast, and then other things which emit in the radio frequency domain, which includes all kinds of things, cell towers for mobile telephony, et cetera. We've been doing that for about 100 years. That means that our technosignature is about 100 light years from Earth. And you think, well, that actually sounds like quite a lot. But bear in mind that the Milky Way galaxy is 100,000 light years across, and it is only one of hundreds of billions of other galaxies. And so, you know, it becomes daunting, and the scales are tough for humans to get our heads around. But nevertheless, there's also the reality that in a 100-year envelope in all directions from Earth, there are not, you know, hundreds of thousands of planetary systems. There's maybe a few hundred. So it is certainly possible that some other civilization within that kind of 100 light year distance from us knows we're here. But also, you know, these signals are very weak. We would not be able to detect with our radio telescopes the kind of signals that we call leakage from planet Earth that have been going on for about 100 years at a 100 light year distance. We might be able to pick them up if they were within 10 or maybe 20 light years. But, you know, the kinds of signals we're looking for are higher energy and based on sort of an assumption that some civilizations might be out there either intentionally or unintentionally sending higher energy signals in our direction. So, yeah, we've been technical for about 100 years.
It's interesting to think about it in those terms, out to about 100 light years. And I hadn't considered that, that like with the Allen Telescope Array up at Hat Creek Radio Observatory that you guys operate, one of the most sophisticated instruments, you know, in the world for doing SETI, it would not be able to detect the Earth at a distance of 100 light years. Is that what you're saying?
That's correct. Yeah. Now, if we were fortunate enough that an Earth-like planet had something like the transmitter on the Arecibo dish in Puerto Rico that we used to have until that dish collapsed a couple of years ago, that transmitter was a 1 megawatt transmitter. It's the most powerful transmitter, you know, we've ever broadcast things into space with. It wasn't used for broadcasting, but it was used for pinging asteroids. So like sonar, mm-hmm. bounce radio wave off of an asteroid, and you can understand its size and its spin and its orbit and figure out whether it might represent a threat or not. If you had a transmitter like that focused through a dish like Arecibo and happened to be pointing in our direction, you know, you'd be able to see that for probably many thousands of light years with the Allen Telescope Array.
If somebody was using an Arecibo-type dish out there and doing the same type of thing, pinging it off of their asteroids, it would be very difficult. You might detect that, but it'd be very difficult to detect it again.
Might be difficult to detect again. And also, what you would detect is what clearly looks like an engineered phenomena. But you know, when you're pinging asteroids, you know, just bouncing radio waves off of them, you're not embedding any information, right? So we would look at this and say, okay, well, this is a technological beacon, but it doesn't appear to contain any structure or any patterns or anything that would suggest or indicate that there's information embedded in it. It's just a ping. It would be still pretty dramatic. And if we were able to say, you know, where this came from and how far away, this would be a SETI discovery and, you know, would make global news, one would imagine, and be a very profound, but it would be, you know, very different than, for example, picking up a signal in which information appears to be contained.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, it also makes me think of the famous WOW signal. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about that. Perhaps that's what that was and why we were never able to detect it again.
You know, that's a very interesting idea. The WOW signal was a signal which, just as you described a moment ago about Arecibo activity, was a one-time ping, if you will. It was picked up by a radio telescope dish, you know, relatively small by today's standards, at Ohio State University. And I'm not entirely sure of exactly what year that was, but it was before the 2000s. And what happened is this was a time when computer data was not being shown on CRTs or LCD screens or things of this nature, or being stored on massive disks and hard drives. It was generating printouts from computer printouts. And, you know, those of us of my generation remember doing that in our college years. And
the old
green
dot matrix printers.
Yeah, those old dot matrix printers and the green and white striped computer paper. And, you know, this computer printout was just a series of numbers and letters and symbols representing what the telescope observed for one evening, and nobody was monitoring it in real time. The printer's just, you know, brr, 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 printing away all night long. And then the next morning, somebody came in and looked at the data, and he saw a string of numbers and letters that suggested a very high energy, somewhat focused beacon of some sort being picked up by the radio telescope. And so he famously wrote in the margins of the paper, letters WOW in capital letters and an exclamation point. And as a result of that, you know, simple notation, this then forever became known as the WOW signal. And it's never been discovered again. We've taken, you know, we didn't have high precision on where the telescope was looking at that point, but we have a pretty good idea. And even recently, as much for sort of public demonstration and fun as real science, the Green Bank Telescope and the Allen Telescope Array of the SETI Institute partnered together to both look at that section of sky again to see if we would see anything interesting, and we did not. So, yeah, that it is possible that the WOW signal was like an Arecibo, you know, transmission from some distant world. It's perhaps more likely it was some passing military aircraft or satellite or whatever, but, you know, we'll never know unless, to your point, we detect it again.
Yeah, intriguing. It's a mystery. Okay, you were telling me earlier, about Frank Drake's license plate. Can you tell us about Frank Drake's license plate? Because that's kind of a cool story.
It's a cool story. And I think this the summa summarum of this story is that the L variable is not only the most provocative and most interesting, I believe, in the Drake equation, but perhaps the most important. So Frank felt that the value of N, the number of technological civilizations that might exist in the Milky Way galaxy, is most dominantly going to be determined by the size of L. How long does a technological civilization remain detectable? How long does that last? Is it hundreds or thousands or hundreds of thousands of years? And needless to say, the longer that time frame, the higher the likelihood of detection. And also, from Frank's point of view, mathematically, the greater the value of N. And so Frank had a vanity plate on his car. And one of the things we know about Frank is he loved his cars, and he wasn't the slowest driver in the world either. He was colorful in that sense as well. But Frank's license plate was the letter N, followed by the letters E, Q, L, S, which was equals, and then the letter L. So Frank's license plate was N equals L. And that was essentially a summary of Frank's perspective on N, that it was all going to be determined by how long the technological civilizations are emitting or transmitting detectable phenomena.
Yeah, and another interesting, you know, thing about the equation is how it works out is, you know, we started out with R sub star, the rate of star formation. So it's a rate. It's something over time. And then our right. final term, L, is time. So when you take, you know, yes. something over time multiplied by time, they cancel and you just get a number. And that's kind of part of the genius of the equation, too.
Yeah, that's a wonderful observation and absolutely correct. You know, most of the variables are not time dependent. You know, what fraction of stars have planets? What fraction of planets are habitable? What fraction of those have life, intelligence, and ultimately technology emerge? These are just values, but you know, they're all ultimately going to be determined, you know, by, well, how long does a host star remain, hospitable host star, for example, and then ultimately how long does a technological civilization remain detectable? So these time referenced, you know, beginnings and endings of the Drake equation, as you say, null out and then help just a single number emerge. But time is a very important element here. And as I often say to people that, you know, SETI is an endeavor not just in space, as in where might they be, but in time, as in when might they be or when might they have been.
Well, then finally, you know, we've been looking at the Drake equation and in terms of N, the number of civilizations out there. Could you just, you know, before we go, can you just kind of give us your overview on the spectrum of, you know, what some of the SETI scientists that you encounter there, you know, think about the value of possible values of N?
Well, I think more or less 100% of people at the Institute think N is non-zero, right? They think it's greater than one being ourselves. But whether that value is small or large, there are differing opinions on that. You know, I think one of the interesting things, and we've of course covered some of that in terms of what we now know in, about the variables of the Drake equation compared to what we knew when it was conceived, things like the fact that planets are ubiquitous and that the percentage of those planets that are rocky and Earth-like and likely in the habitable zone of their host star in our own galaxy is in the tens or possibly even hundreds of billions. And I think we've also discovered that life is quite robust. For example, it's almost impossible to completely sterilize, you know, a lander or rover like Curiosity or Perseverance before sending them to Mars and guarantee that they have no life on board. It's virtually impossible. So life seems to be quite robust, quite adaptable. And on Earth, it exists in environments that 20 or 30 years ago, we would have thought are impossible, you know, from the middle of rocks to underneath, you know, the 3 to 4 meters of permanent ice cover in the Antarctic. So we find life in extraordinarily broad environments. So my own take is that, you know, I think we're going to discover that just as we learned that planets are common, not rare, I think we're going to learn that life is also common, not rare, that life is likely to be an emergent process. That's the perspective, for example, of Natalie Cabral, who's the head of research here. And therefore, you know, life is going to be something that we find all over the place. And if that's the case, I think then the probability that L or that F sub C is something meaningful. In other words, the emergence of technological civilizations. And L is hopefully long enough, suggests that N, you know, may be a reasonably large number and that we have a good chance. But here's the other thing, is the chance of finding intelligent life beyond Earth is zero if we don't look. So I think Frank was right. You know, it's all going to come down to how long does a technological civilization remain detectable?
Well, on that fascinating note, I want to thank you for being our guide to the Drake Equation here in 2024 and this fascinating voyage through space and time and all of this incredible, wonderful questioning and conjecture about all of these variables in the Drake Equation. And what a fascinating voyage it's been. Thanks for being our guide for this, Bill.
Well, it's been a great pleasure, Dave, honestly, and of course, always fun to have the opportunity to engage our scientists who are, you know, much smarter and knowledgeable in these areas than I am. But to have a guided tour together with you has been great fun.
Thanks again to our guests, SETI Institute astronomers Lawrence Doyle and Sophia Shake. And of course, very special thanks to my friend and co-host Bill Diamond, President and CEO of the SETI Institute in Mountain View, California. And a special shout out to Rebecca McDonald, Director of Communications for the SETI Institute, for her kind assistance in producing this two-part program. You can find out more about the SETI Institute's fascinating work at SETI.org. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio, a service of Cap Radio in beautiful and talented Northern California. We're distributed by PRX. If you want to revisit, share, or check out past episodes, you can do just that on our website, mynspr.org. And while you're at it, subscribe to our podcast so you never miss an episode on our website, the NPR One app, or wherever you get your podcast groove on. Our theme music, Big Wave Dave, is by Matt Schiltz. Blue Dot is engineered and produced by the maestro, Matt Fidler. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.